I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Congress is in recess, and some may think their elected officials are on vacation. But for Representative Charisse Davids, she's using the break to hear the concerns of her constituents. Today, we'll learn where the Congresswoman has been working and listening back home in Kansas's 3rd District and why. Plus, we'll ask Davids how optimistic she is that gun control measures will pass this year. Then, in Missouri, unpaid court-ordered child support has the potential to land you behind bars. So how does that get the necessary money to the kids who need it? We have a panel who will tell us if there are any alternatives to jail. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Kansas Representative Charisse Davids is enjoying her first August recess as a member of Congress. She's been working everyday jobs to get a sense of what employees in her district face each day. She's been meeting with constituents and business leaders while also demanding that Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell take up gun safety measures that the House has already passed. We were curious about what she's been hearing and doing, and we're about to find out. Representative Charisse Davids represents the 3rd District of Kansas. Congresswoman, nice to have you. Welcome back.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
What does a freshman member of Congress do during her first August recess? What have you been up to?
Well, I thought you gave a pretty good overview and synopsis there. I have been spending a lot of time meeting with constituents as much as I can. The Charisse shift, which you brought up, has been... I've been doing a number of those.
This is where you go out and you work with everyday Kansans and their jobs. Yeah.
And sometimes it's with small business owners. Sometimes it's, you know, I went out to the air traffic control center. Don't worry, I wasn't actually controlling any air traffic. And double checked before I even walked out onto the floor that there was absolutely no way I could do anything to mess anything up.
Right.
And, you know, recently I was on a radio station as a guest DJ, so I'm feeling a little more comfortable with these headphones on. And I also, not too long ago, got the chance to go over to Jones Barbecue, and I was helping them put orders together, and it kind of reminded me of my days when I worked at Sonic. I worked at Sonic for like 5 years. So.
Like 5 years?
Yeah.
What do you hope to get out of experiences like this? What's your objective here?
You know, one of the biggest things that I could already see it almost immediately when I started spending about half of my time in D.C. when we're in session and we're voting. I'm out in D.C. having very kind of high level policy conversations. We're talking legislation all the time. And when I come back home, it's a really good way to reconnect with the literally the everyday issues that folks are trying to deal with. I went over and one of my Charisse's shift was with UPS, and you know, I was moving some packages around and that sort of thing. But one of the bigger takeaways was that I got a chance to talk to a couple of the people who, you know, they were talking about what it's like to have the healthcare coverage that they have because of you know, they're unionized, so the union helps them get healthcare. And then a small business owner, you know, Jones Barbecue is obviously a very popular spot. I could tell not just from the great coverage that they get, but from the long line that was outside the whole time, and listening to them talk about what it's like to try to get a second smoker and making that investment and how hard it can be to access capital sometimes for small businesses. I sit on the Small Business Committee, and those are exactly the kind of things that I need to be hearing about.
So it sounds like you're saying that the August recess does not translate to the August vacation for a member of Congress.
Yeah, actually, I've been saying over the last week or so, I got to come up with a better name than August recess because at least for me, and I know a bunch of the other freshman members of Congress, we're spending a lot of time trying to make sure that we're listening to the constituents. And, you know, I definitely want to make sure that the voice that our district has in Washington, D.C. is one that you know, I need to be well-versed in all of the priorities and issues.
I'm visiting with Kansas Congresswoman Charisse Davids. I'm wondering, Congresswoman, what are you hearing from your constituents? Any themes emerging as you make your way around the district?
Well, there's definitely themes around health care. You know, that was the biggest issue that was being brought up during the campaign cycle.
Right.
And it continues to be so. In fact, you know, we had a prescription drug roundtable. I've been doing these roundtables as a way to actually get into more of the meat of some of the specific topics. And prescription drug costs is something that a lot of people bring up. So we did a roundtable, and one of the guests actually, or participants in the roundtable, Laura, her daughter is a diabetic. She was diagnosed when she was 5, and the cost of their insulin to get her daughter insulin has quadrupled. Four times as much as it was when she was 5, and she's 19 now.
Right.
And you know, hearing the very specific, and sometimes like people share very vulnerable issues that their families are facing, and certainly deciding between purchasing life-saving prescriptions for your children and whether or not you can, you know, buy enough food for the month that's a very personal story for someone to share with me. And it led to I don't know if you were going to bring this up, but it led to me asking the Committee on Oversight and Reform to put together a report specifically about insulin and the rising cost of insulin and what's the impact on the 3rd District in Kansas.
You know, and what did that report find out? What did you learn?
Well, it really put into context some of the, you know, like hard numbers. Mm-hmm. The approximately 66,000 people who are uninsured, who are, you know, having to, you know, of those people, diabetes is a very, very common disease. You know, they're struggling to get insulin, and also that even for the people who do have insurance, our district in some instances pays like 20 plus times or 14 times, if in the case of the UK, 14 times more than folks in the UK are paying for insulin. And I think having those hard numbers along with the real life impacts is really helpful when I'm trying to figure out what legislation to support. And
you know, Congresswoman David from Overland Park emailed us a question just on the point you're making. He said he read your report on insulin prices, and one of your summary points is that Medicare beneficiaries pay significantly more for their drugs than patients abroad because Medicare lacks the authority to negotiate directly with drug manufacturers. We've been hearing about this for a while. Why is the U.S. government, this is David's question here, handcuffing itself when it comes to these to those negotiating the cost of drugs? I mean, why are we doing it that way?
Yeah, and folks out there can't see me, but I was nodding my head along listening to that comment and question, because I completely agree. The fact that the federal government with so much purchasing power isn't harnessing that to make sure that we're bringing down the cost of prescription drugs for folks who are making use of Medicare is absolutely something that we need to be addressing. And I know that in the House, we're looking at ways to not only to make it so that Medicare can negotiate prescription drug costs, but also to increase transparency in drug pricing, because that's a huge issue.
Yes.
Making sure that generics are getting to market much quicker, because that also leads to higher costs.
But you're pushing up against the pharmaceutical lobby, which I'm only guessing is enormous and has lots of money to throw around on Capitol Hill.
And frankly, we're pushing up against the members of the I was going to say members of the Senate. That sounds kind of funny. Mm-hmm. The senators who aren't bringing these things. And I'm glad you mentioned earlier that I've been calling on Mitch McConnell to do his job. Mm-hmm. You know, the fact that the House has passed multiple bills, we passed 5 bills addressing this specific issue.
Gun issues, you're saying.
And then not just gun issues. I mean,
and also pharmaceuticals.
Prescription drug costs, increasing transparency in drug pricing. We have passed bills to do just this. And Mitch McConnell has, I mean, the fact that Mitch McConnell accepts and has taken on the nickname of the Grim Reaper is it's upsetting, frankly, but it also demonstrates the hurdles that we have to get through to even. I mean, our job is to represent the people and to try to figure out ways to help people get access to healthcare, mm-hmm. to get access to affordable medications that literally save people's lives. And I'm just going to keep saying that Mitch McConnell needs to do his job.
What are you hearing on a slightly different topic when it comes to gun violence? Mm-hmm. We've had the mass shootings of late in this country. What are your constituents saying about that and what they want to see happen here?
Well, our country has seen so many tragedies around this, and to have a 24-hour period where we saw two horrific mass shootings, and our community here in the Kansas City area was impacted by gun violence as well. When mm-hmm. you know, we had a young woman who lived in the 3rd District pass away in an act of violence in the Crossroads.
That first Friday's, yeah.
Yeah, it's mm-hmm. it is it's a place where, when I think about growing up and having a lot of respect for the power of firearms, you know, my mom was in the Army, she was a drill sergeant. I had the chance to I actually learned how to shoot when I was very young. Mm-hmm. The first time I picked up a firearm, I was pretty young, and had a lot of gun safety education around that experience. And mm-hmm. Also, you know, I think that there are so many people who support just common sense gun safety measures.
Yeah.
And background checks is certainly something that the House has. We've already passed legislation to for universal background checks to close loopholes.
In fact, speaking of Mitch McConnell, you've joined in an effort on a statement to get him to pass the House's mm-hmm. gun measures that you just alluded to here, implementing universal background checks, closing loopholes in gun purchases. Why is this so important in your view?
It's about safety, mm-hmm. you know, and we're having a roundtable. Speaking of the roundtables that I've been
this weekend, I
holding,
think.
Yeah, we're mm-hmm. having a roundtable this weekend to focus on this very issue, and we're going to be hearing from the young people who, I mean, we have a whole generation of kids who have to practice lockdown drills in school. Mm-hmm. We're going to be hearing from parents and, you know, the moms who are sending their kids to school and wondering how safe they're going to be, who are wondering how safe they're going to be if they're going back to school shopping or going to the mall. And I think that
we're selling bulletproof backpacks now.
Yeah. And mm-hmm. These things are it's untenable. You know, we have to be hearing from the people who are impacted. We also need to be listening to and engaging with the state level lawmakers. We've seen in Florida, their state legislature came together and passed some common sense safety measures to protect our communities. Mm-hmm. I feel like one of the most basic functions, similar to infrastructure, which is a basic function of the government, it's to keep people safe.
Well, given that, how optimistic are you that the U.S. Senate's going to take up this measure and do something when you all return this fall?
You know, I would say I often use the phrase realistically optimistic. Mm-hmm. I don't think that it's going to happen easily, but I do think if we keep putting at the House colleagues keep putting pressure on the Senate, as if we keep having all the community activism and advocacy that we've seen, you know, the Moms Demand Action, the Students Demand Action, March for Our Lives, this continues to be very, very active after the Parkland incident. I think that all of us should be putting pressure on our senators to take up to at a minimum take up the bills that have already been passed at the House level, and also be putting pressure to really be forward thinking on how we can address issues of gun safety.
You mentioned, we talked about the power of the pharmaceutical industry. You've mentioned the power of the gun lobby here in a statement you issued about this. You said this, Congresswoman, like all issues, this comes down to a choice. Do you put the safety of children and families first and pass common sense gun safety laws, or do you put the gun lobby first, take their money, and do their bidding?
And I don't often, I try not to stray outside of specific questions too much, but I do want to bring up the fact that how disappointed I am and how unacceptable I think it is that the president this morning got on the phone with the head of the most powerful gun lobby and really said, if you don't support background checks, I don't support that. Mm-hmm. I think that having the president give us a key example of, on this very issue is, again, I feel like this is the it's a mirror for so many of the lawmakers to see. Are you putting the safety of children and families first, or are you putting the
right
interests of the NRA or the gun lobby first?
You know, some questions off the news, Congresswoman. You weren't happy when Israel denied the right to enter that country to two Democratic colleagues of yours in the House. You said this, this action is not in line with the values we hold as democracies, and it's wrong. I'm wondering, how does this affect this country's relationship with Israel? How do you see this thing playing out going forward?
Well, I don't know exactly how things are going to play out going forward. You know, the I did come out with a statement because I found the denial of the entry for the two congresswomen to be unacceptable.
Mm-hmm.
It certainly is a really dangerous precedent to set. You know, if we're going to be if our countries are going to continue to have a strong allyship, it requires that we have an open door policy between the two countries for our lawmakers and for the you know, the government leaders to have conversations, even when, you know, I don't agree with everything that my two colleagues and other colleagues in the House Democratic
right
caucus hold, but that doesn't mean that we don't have conversations about those disagreements. And
yep,
I think that denying the entry was, you know, like a lot of we had Democrats and Republicans across the board saying, this is a bad precedent to set.
In the wake of this, some of your colleagues are talking about cutting U.S. aid to Israel. Could you support something like that?
I think that we have to really evaluate. Anytime we're talking about appropriations and funding, we have to constantly be in a state of evaluation. I'm not in a place right now where I'm, you know, gonna say what I would support or not support in terms of funding levels, especially as we move into this place where we have to pass some appropriations bills, you know, to make sure that we don't have another government shutdown. And that means that, you know, I usually don't like to jump out ahead of myself and say, here's what I want to see, because a lot of times that's such a big dialogue.
Mark from Kansas City, Kansas is joining us. Mark, you're on with Congresswoman Davids. Good morning.
Well, good morning to you, and good morning, Congresswoman, and of course you, Steve.
Good morning.
So, good morning. I'd like to follow up on this discussion regarding Israel. The president just accused Jews, American Jews who vote for Democrats, as either woefully ignorant or disloyal. On the other hand, Congresswoman, I'm not that upset that the Israelis denied access to the two congresswomen. They booked. I'd like you to investigate the organization that they booked their trip through. It is a known purveyor of anti-Semitism. Congresswoman, I believe it was Omar, just did something in regards to a cartoon. She honored, I believe, a cartoonist who participated in Iran's Holocaust denial cartoon contest.
Mark, give me a question for the Congresswoman, if you would.
Congresswoman, I'd like you to be more forthwhile regarding your stand about cutting aid to Israel, and I'd like you to give your expression about your opinion on the anti-Semitism of your two colleagues.
Okay. Congresswoman, you want to respond?
Well, I would say that, you know, just what I said earlier about funding, those are complex funding packages that require a lot of back and forth and dialogue about where the spending is going to go, mm-hmm. Whether it's aid or, you know, any other kind of spending that we do around foreign affairs. The second thing is anti-Semitism is on the rise. Like, there is no question about that. And, you know, some of the things that you were talking about, I'm actually not familiar with and I don't think that it's good for me to be commenting about support or not support of some of the things that you were talking about with either of the two congresswomen. I mean, I'm absolutely against forms of anti-Semitism, no matter where they're coming from or who's participating them, whether or not it's, you know, political leaders questioning anybody's loyalty. That is actually an anti-Semitic trope for for a political leader to be saying that about, you know, American Jewish people is very troubling to me.
Do you have any reason to think that some of your fellow members of Congress are anti-Semitic?
No, I don't. I don't think that the actions that we've seen out of the Democratic caucus or members of the Democratic caucus have sent a message of anything but support for fighting hate, mm-hmm. fighting anti-Semitism, fighting Islamophobia, fighting racism in general. In fact, I co-sponsored a bill that the Democratic, a lot of my Democratic colleagues are signing on to. It's called the No Hate Act. You know, we're trying to figure out ways to make sure that this rise in hate crimes, this rise in anti-Semitism is being addressed.
A couple other things off the news, Congresswoman. The president said yesterday that he's considering a temporary payroll tax cut or other tax changes amid mounting concerns about what could be an economic slowdown. The Obama administration once did something similar. How much merit does that idea have in your view?
I'm not sure. I mean, I'd have to look back at what President Obama did.
Right.
Look at the proposal that that the current president is putting forward. Speaking of all the feedback that I've been getting from constituents, I will say that I've had a number of folks recently talk to me about their concern about the U.S. debt. The U.S. deficit and our need to make sure that we're, you know, that we're being responsible because it's our grandchildren and great grandchildren who are going to have to deal with this.
Yeah.
Multiple people over the last week have brought that issue up to me, and having the president talk about cutting payroll taxes or cutting any of the revenue coming into the federal government, It seems like one of the things that folks are concerned about.
The president has also floated the idea of purchasing Greenland. Has the time come for this country to expand, Congresswoman?
That is not a proposal that I would have probably ever put forward. Mm-hmm. And it's an interesting proposal from the president right now. I'm not sure. It feels pretty out of the blue. Or out of the green, I don't know. I think that the president's pretty unpredictable on some of this stuff.
Since you were last on, Congressman Cleaver from the Missouri side of the state line has said he wants to launch an impeachment inquiry into President Trump following former special counsel Robert Mueller's testimony to Congress. Cleaver was on the fence on this issue for a long time, and there's a sense that his shifting position here could put more heat on members like you who haven't been up front on this issue or out front on this issue. Where are you right now?
I'm glad you mentioned that Cleaver has, you know, his kind of path to getting to his decision.
Right.
I don't think that it puts pressure on other members because we're all on our own decision-making path. We all have our own process. I think you probably know that I'm very process-oriented.
Mm-hmm.
I have, you know, I think I said this last time, I have read the Mueller report. I went back and referenced it a little bit before the Mueller testimony because I wanted to make sure that if he said anything different, that I would know that. He didn't seem to say anything different than what was in the report.
Right.
I continue to trust that my colleagues on the Judiciary Committee and then the other relevant committees, you know, intelligence, they're for sure the intelligence committee is doing a lot of work around the election interference issue, which is a huge issue and something that I would like us to make sure we keep at the forefront of our minds as we move into future election cycles, is making sure that we're addressing any potential for election interference by Russia or any other country. I think that this is a process that the Judiciary Committee is handling in the same way. I don't want them coming in on the Boeing oversight that the committee I'm the vice chair of and
right.
aviation. I don't want them telling us how to do our Boeing oversight and FAA certification process oversight. I've been doing my diligence and I'm ready to really evaluate the recommendations that they come to the full house with.
Okay. That's Kansas Congresswoman Charisse Davids from the state's 3rd District. Congresswoman, thanks for sharing your views. Always great to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
When we come back, we'll try to answer the question, should poor folks who can't pay child support be thrown in jail? I'm Steve Kraske. You're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you're not subscribed to my weekly newsletter, I've got a question for you. Why not? It's never too late. Judge John Torrance is going to sign up this afternoon. Go to kcur.org/Kraske to sign up. There's exclusive insights from me and highlights from the up-to-date team. Don't wait. Go to kcur.org/Kraske. Tomorrow on the show, as gun violence continues to plague Kansas City and the nation, we'll take a look at the role of religious leaders, churches, and faith in the quest to curb gun violence. Well, if you're a divorced parent and have money, paying child support is an obligation, and the law says that obligation must be met. But what if the person responsible for paying that child support is poor, out of work, or even out of luck? What if their main concern is where their next meal comes from? What happens then? Critics say that too often the response is the loss of a driver's license, making getting a job all the more difficult, or even jail time. The result, they can't get a job because they have a criminal record, so they can't pay that child support. It all amounts to what critics say is a criminalization of poverty, or at least that's the argument. Next in our series looking at the poor and court-ordered expenses, we examine the logic of jailing someone who can't pay child support. What other options do courts have? With us are Jackson County Circuit Court Judge John Torrance. Judge, always good to have you here. Welcome.
Glad to be here.
Melissa Maurer-Smith is also here. She's director of the Family Support Unit of the Jackson County Prosecutor's Office. Melissa, good morning to you.
Thank you for having me.
Matthew Mueller is back. He's a senior bond litigation counsel for the Missouri Public Defender's Office. Matthew, how are you?
Fine. Thank you for having me.
Matthew, what's going on here? Are poor people going to jail because they can't pay court-ordered child support, and is that a good idea?
The answer is yes. We have people going to jail as well as going to state prison for not paying court-ordered child support. And again, the difference usually is whether the prosecuting attorney's office is seeking to enforce the court-ordered child support civilly or criminally. And our office represents people who have been charged criminally for failing to pay court-ordered child support.
And you have some issue with the whole criminalization of this, do I understand right?
That's right, yeah. By definition, we represent indigent people, and so these are people who don't have a lot of money and who may be unable to pay the court-ordered child support and are now being faced with criminal charges for failing to pay their court-ordered child support.
You know, I've heard you talk about a case you handled to put a face on this situation, Matthew, involving a man from St. Joseph who was sent to prison for failing to pay the court-ordered amount of $500 a month in child support. Tell us about this case again so we can put a face on this.
Sure. So this is a man who was charged with the crime of criminal non-support in St. Joseph, Missouri. He is now in prison for failing to pay his court-ordered child support.
Mm-hmm.
We have this case pending right now in the Court of Appeals in Kansas City. So these cases often follow a common trajectory. They are charged criminally. The probable cause statement states only that they have failed to pay their court-ordered child support. My client, Mr. Wolf, pleaded guilty to that, and he was placed on probation. And the only condition of his probation was that he pay the court-ordered child support. When he failed to pay the court-ordered child support, his probation was revoked. That was the only reason he was revoked, and he is now serving 4 years in prison for failing to pay. Our argument is Missouri law has a statute which says that you can make payment of court-ordered child support a condition of probation in criminal cases. That's not the issue. But the law further specifies that the amount that is ordered cannot exceed 50% of the person's adjusted gross income. And mm-hmm. so that is the issue. For that order of $500 a month to be lawful, in our view, there had to be evidence in the record that Mr. Wolf was making at least $1,000 a month in adjusted gross income.
And that wasn't there.
That wasn't there. And we know that from the application he filled out for Public Defender Services.
Now, Melissa, you work in the prosecutor's office for the Family Support Unit, and you've got a lot of sway in cases like this. What's your take on what Matthew is talking about, and how serious of a problem does Missouri have here?
Well, and I think it's different. The thing that it is different in every county. In Jackson County, we handle things very differently than they do in the case that he's been working on and is on appeal. In Jackson County, we use more of a diversionary model, and we mostly file civil contempt actions. We don't file but about 5% of our cases or less in criminal actions, and we only file those when we don't have jurisdiction to file anything else. The prosecutor's office, as you know, I know you've had conversations with our prosecutor, has several diversionary programs. We've got New Start to help people with nonviolent felonies get their cases dismissed if they finish certain things, drug court, veterans court, mental health court. We've had a child support court in Jackson County since 1998, and we assist primarily low-income, unemployed people with barriers who have a court order to pay, and we work together with a team, and generally there's a public defender if it's a criminal case. Most of the time the people are unrepresented, and we help them to get to services that can move some of those barriers for them so they can get a job. Our goal is
The goal is to help these folks out and hopefully get them to be able to resume paying their child support at some point down the road.
Absolutely. What we're looking for is get to the point where you can make some kind of regular payment on a monthly basis.
But clearly, though, that's not happening around the state. Melissa, do I hear that right?
I think every county is different. And I was having a conversation with Matthew before this. He was explaining to me some of what he's seeing. The Family Support Division, which is the Missouri agency that manages and handles child support cases, does have a lot of programs to help people. And if someone owes child support and calls in, they should be able to get them to some resources to assist them if they are low income or they've lost their job or they need resources. But you have to communicate, and that's the challenge. I think there are some opportunities in most of the counties to get some assistance. Now, obviously, there are some extreme circumstances.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, at what point for your office does criminalization get triggered? What do you need to see before you're going to say this person is not acting in good faith, he or she needs to go to prison?
Well, and every case is individual.
Sure.
We presently do not have anyone in the state prison system for criminal non-support out of Jackson County.
Okay.
It would be the last resort. And if we charge somebody, we like to put them into a program where we can help them divert from being convicted of a crime.
Right.
We want to collect money. We don't want to get somebody a conviction that's going to prevent them from getting employed.
Judge Torrance, is it also your view that Jackson County is handling this in a way that some might describe as more humane?
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's been doing that for really a number of years.
Yeah.
The kind of thing that Matt's talking about here, I don't think has happened since I've been on the bench. I've not heard of it.
Of it happening around the state, Judge?
Yes. Yeah, it happens. It makes no sense to incarcerate somebody that you want to get money from. It makes no sense to give a conviction to somebody if you're hoping that they're going to be able to generate income for their children and support them. And I think Gene Baker's office, Melissa's unit, has been really very progressive and forward-thinking in handling this in a decent and ultimately sensible way.
You know, Judge, you hear this phrase all the time, deadbeat dads. People have an image of folks who don't pay child support out there. Do you have an overall sense? I mean, how often are people well-intentioned and how often are people really trying to, you know, get back at an ex-spouse or whatever? How do you view the world?
My sense of it is it's a small fraction of people that are actually willfully, purposefully wanting to hurt the ex at the expense of their own children. They're there. They're out there. And to be clear about this, you know, you cannot even civilly enforce an order through contempt unless you find that the party that's obligated to pay is willfully doing it, having been proven capable of paying it. They're choosing not to.
Yeah.
That's what contempt proceeding. It's not that much different than a criminal charge, but you have to be able to prove both that they have the capacity to earn the money such that they would be able to pay their child support, and having that capacity, they're willfully choosing not to do it.
You know, Judge, as you sit up on the bench, how difficult is it for you to determine whether any client out there is indeed able to pay or not? I mean, I imagine, you know, numbers are fungible. You must hear all kinds of stories. How hard is it for you to figure out just how much money somebody has?
It depends on the evidence. I mean, the lawyers that are involved in the cases have to prove what the elements of the claim are. If they can't prove actual earning capacity or actual earnings, then, you know, it's an easy call. On the other hand, if you've got somebody in front of you, which happens not infrequently, who's, you know, on SSI, they're getting Social Security disability, you know where you're at in that case. And
yeah.
You're not going to get money out of this person.
Someone who's on SSI, can you expect them to pay child support?
A little.
A very little.
Very little.
Yeah. You know, Matthew, we're sitting here talking about this and getting a larger sense here that there's not a big problem in Jackson County. So what is the issue across the state from your vantage point? How big of an issue do we have?
Sure. So I contacted the Department of Corrections. That's the state prison system here in Missouri. And I asked how many people we have right now in state prison for criminal non-support. We have 368 individuals in state prison for failure to pay child support. But the charge is criminal non-support. Just to give you an idea. We have 359 people in for assault in the first degree. That is serious assault causing serious physical harm to another individual. So we have more people in state prison right now for criminal non-support, that is failure to pay child support, than we do for serious bodily assault.
And your view of that would be what? How do you regard that information?
Well, to go off Judge Torrance's point, we do have a disconnect because here in Jackson County, they enforce child support obligations civilly. Ideally, that is what I would like to see across the state, but we don't have that.
But I was going to say the law is not being applied equally based on what you're telling me here.
Yeah, that's correct. And just to go off Judge Torrance's point, if you do pursue enforcement of child support obligations civilly, there are a number of requirements that must be met. For example, in determining what the monthly child support should be, you have to calculate a Form 14. You have to determine what the gross adjusted income is. We don't do that in criminal non-support cases. When someone pleads guilty and they're put on probation, we don't calculate a new Form 14. Is that a good idea or is that a bad idea?
Mm-hmm.
Another issue is if you're going to find someone in civil contempt civilly for not paying child support, the court must first find that the person has the ability to pay. We don't do that in criminal non-support cases. Criminally, someone often is – it's often the case – It's the case for my client, Mr. Wolf. He was revoked on probation and sent to state prison without any inquiry as to his ability to pay that $500 a month child support obligation.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date. We're talking about child support cases and in what circumstances does a parent who's not paying that child support wind up in state prison as opposed to facing a civil situation. Our phone number here, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. Well, you know, Melissa, I'm hearing here that the law is not being applied in a standard way across the state. What do you make of that? Should I be surprised?
I don't think that's
what I thought about the textbooks say about how the law is supposed to be applied here.
I think every county does things differently. That we were having that conversation earlier today. The prosecutor kind of sets the precedent for what's going to happen in that county, and we've been very progressive in Jackson County. We've had progressive prosecutors who looked at things in a realistic fashion and realized that people do have barriers to paying support, and a criminal history is a barrier. Addiction is a barrier. Homelessness is a barrier. We have people who basically have, they lack life skills. They don't know how to manage their money, or they haven't gotten a good education, or they never had a job that didn't pay cash. And so some of those folks are, they, you know, didn't come to court when they got the order. They didn't come to court to present income information, some of those kind of things, because they are kind of afraid of the system, or they don't understand what's going on. And once they get into that, then we, you know, we end up with those problems. But we try to have them come and communicate with us to tell us what's going on, explain their situation, see what we have resources that can help them. The state has agreements with many different agencies statewide that can assist people with employment.
Judge, explain the law to me here a little bit. How can it be that a person in Jackson County who's not paying child support might face a civil situation, be involved in a civil case? A similar person out in rural Missouri might be sent to state prison in Jefferson City or somewhere else around the state for any number of years. Is that a problem?
Well, the short answer, and I don't mean to be flippant,
Which you're never known to be, you know.
Elections matter. Yeah. And elected officials in different counties view things differently according to what they perceive to be what their constituents want. And, it's always been the case. Zip codes have always mattered. How cases are handled varies all over the state. It varies sometimes within a circuit. You know, when you get into an outstate county, things could be done differently in different counties within the same circuit, which is presided over by the same presiding circuit judge. That's reality. It's always been that way. And, you know, not every prosecutor sees this in the same fashion.
Hey, does the Public Defender's Office of the State of Missouri, Matthew, have a problem with this?
Oh, yes, certainly. That's one of my new sort of projects I'm working on is to help provide some relief for our clients who are being sent to state prison solely for criminal non-support, failure to pay their court-ordered child support.
Can you go resurrect those cases and take them up one at a time? Is it that kind of thing?
Sure. That's what I've been doing for the most part. We are seeking what's called post-conviction relief for many individuals who are currently in state prison. We are also seeking relief.
Can you get them released?
Well, that's the goal. I mean, we have these issues pending right now on appeal, so the outcome of those cases remains to be seen. But yeah, ideally, it is possible for these people to be released. Like in Mr. Wolf's case, the individual out of St. Joseph, Missouri, a successful outcome in his case on appeal would be to get him released, to get his conviction vacated for that criminal non-support charge.
Let's go to Bill from Independence. Bill, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead, Bill.
I just wanted to make a comment about people such as myself who are self-employed in commission sales. I had a relationship 20 years ago where I had child support due. I lost half my monthly income from one client, and the court was not sensitive to the fact that I couldn't afford to pay at that time for some period of time the amount that I was mandated to pay. It doesn't lend itself to that type of business. It assumes everyone has a paycheck, wages, or salary, and that's not going to change.
What about that, Judge? Do you want to comment on that?
Sure. It does present a different kind of a challenge when someone has self-employment income.
Right.
But again, what a judge decides is going to be dependent on the evidence that's produced. If everything goes the way it should go and both sides are clearly put into the record, there should be a fair determination. I don't know what happened in this caller's case, but whether it's self-employment income or salaried income, it's all subject to proper calculation.
Yeah. I hope that helps, Bill.
Okay. This is some time ago, but I just wanted to make a point that the system didn't seem to be very sensitive to those changes in income.
Right. Appreciate that. Melissa, did your boss, Prosecutor Jean Peters Baker, has she made it known publicly that this is her stance on how she's going to handle cases like this? How does she handle something like this?
She and I have had discussions about it, so I assume that she has had those conversations with others publicly, that we don't generally file criminal cases, and especially not in the first occurrence. We want people to get access all the services that might be available to them to help them move to paying some kind of support. And she's always been very supportive of that.
Yeah. I can't help but notice, Matthew, that the new St. Louis County prosecutor has just been there for a number of months. Wesley Bell has said that in many cases, he's not going to criminally prosecute those who fail to pay child support. He's gotten some flack for it.
Yeah, he has. And I think what he's doing, or what he aims to do, is what Jackson County is doing, that they are going to now enforce child support obligations civilly.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that ideally is what we at the Public Defender's Office would like to see, because there are so many protections in place for civil contempt proceedings that aren't necessarily in place or enforced to the same extent in the criminal context.
Have you surveyed the counties in Missouri to get a sense of how many counties are taking the Jackson County approach and how many are taking a more jail time approach?
Yeah, I have. So I contacted the Department of Corrections, like I mentioned a moment ago, and I got a list of all the individuals who are in prison, and I looked to see what counties their charges arose from. And we do see certain counties incarcerate people more for this type of offense than other counties. Going off Ms. Smith's point, there are no people from Jackson County in state prison. However, we have a number of people from St. Joseph, Missouri, Buchanan County, mm-hmm. who are in prison for this. We have a number of people from Clay County, which is in Liberty, Missouri, just 20 mm-hmm. miles north of here, who are in prison for criminal non-support. So there are differences in terms of where you are in the state. If you have child support obligations here in Jackson County, you will not be threatened with prison.
All right. We're going to leave our conversation there. That was the voice of Matthew Mueller, is a senior bond litigation counsel for the Missouri Public Defender's Office. We are also joined by Melissa Maurer-Smith with the Jackson County Prosecutor's Office and Jackson County Circuit Court Judge John Torrance. Thank you all for a good conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Tomorrow, when it comes to gun violence and pushing for solutions to it, should religious leaders take a stand on behalf of the church? We'll talk with local ministers. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.